Welcome to the War Room with Mike Blanco. Prepare yourself to get dropped into a new subject each week as a soldier's diligence meets entrepreneurial challenges in today's marketplace. So sit back and enjoy the tactics of the War Room with Michael Blanco. Here's your host.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? Thanks for tuning into the War Room podcast. I'm your host, Mike Blanco. We have an incredible topic for discussion today. So I was talking to a good buddy of mine, just on Instant Messenger, nothing too serious. We're going back and forth about his experiences in command, because he's a commander over at Fort Bragg, and, you know, life in general and my podcast. And he says to me, he's like, what you really need to talk about on your podcast, man, is this topic that is constantly in the back of the minds of everybody in the conventional force, transitioning veterans and veterans. But it's one of those things that while we all think it, nobody wants to say it out loud. And when he dropped the subject on me, I was like, man, that is 100% accurate. That's on the minds of people in the conventional force. It's on the minds of people transitioning from the military. And it's on the minds of veterans who have served, you know, just over a long period of time, and especially throughout the last 19 years, throughout the forever wars. And the topic is slightly controversial. And so I'll drop it on you, and it's going to break some hearts and hurt some feelings. But what Freedom Dave said to me, he's like, Mike, what you need to talk about is how Special Forces Operations does not have a monopoly on leadership. And I was like, man, yeah, that's 100% right. And there's a whole bunch of reasons we should talk about that. Why I decided to bring it up, because I've gone to several conferences in the last several months. I've met a lot of people, been traveling around the country, around the world. I was in for a little bit. And all of these conferences I go to, what I run into at these talks and these panel discussions that I'm involved in terms of business or startups, or how we are able to better leverage veterans in corporate America or in corporations just in general, there's always the Navy SEAL or the Green Beret, right? There's always somebody up there. Everybody wants to hear from the guy that was on SEAL Team 6 or was a Green Beret. These guys, and I'm not taking anything away from the Special Forces community, they are great professionals. They are the tip of the spear, and they are very good at what they do. However, they do not have a monopoly on military leadership, right? So the way I kind of phrase this to people often, especially when I'm talking to CEOs or COOs, when they ask me, and I've been asked several times, like, well, Mike, were you in Special Forces operations? Like, no, I was not. And they're like, oh, really? Well, that's, you know, I was talking to my buddy who, you know, did this and that and everything else, and this is what he had to say about leadership. And it kind of goes back to this, and this is what I constantly tell CEOs when they bring up this topic. Imagine if you would, a lion. Right? The lion leads what? Another pack of lions, right? So when you're leading a pack of lions, it's not hard. And I'm not, again, not taking anything away from the special operations community. It's not hard to lead other lions, right? Because they're of a similar makeup. They have similar training. They have a similar background. Everybody has similar ambitions, right? When you're a lion leading lions, you know what to expect from the lions to your left and your right. Right. And it's the same with Special Forces operators. Now, obviously, within their own right, they are tremendous leaders. They're very good at personal leadership, very good at self-awareness, and really good at team leadership. Right. But going back to my analogy, a lion is, by and large, able to lead a pack of lions. And in the Special Forces community, they are afforded an opportunity to really hone their profession. These guys are consummate professionals. They're extremely good at what they do. Their pipeline for training, in some cases, can be 4 years long, right? So at the end of that, when they join a team or they go in, it doesn't matter what branch of service you're talking about, right? Whether it's the Green Berets or it's the Navy SEALs, PJs, whomever. They're surrounded by people that are essentially like them. Now, yeah, of course, they come from different backgrounds and everything else like that. But at the end of the day, what you have is a group of individuals that have a similar background in terms of training, similar ambitions, similar goals, right? So everybody's moving in the same direction. A lion can turn to a lion and say, hey, this is what we're going to go do. And that pack of lions like, yeah, let's go do it. Everybody knows how to do it. And they're going to move out. And that's your special forces operations, right? But the vast majority of us, and this is what I find a little bit ironic, right? Because there's not an organization out there, there's not a company out there that is full of lions, right? None of us are fortunate enough to work within an organization. I'm talking about the conventional military as well, right? I'm not just talking about corporate America. None of us are as fortunate to really work with a group of lions. So what are we working with really in the reality of life, whether it's a conventional force in the military or it's corporate America, right? You're dealing with a lion typically who's trying to lead two donkeys, a couple of wolves, maybe a tiger or two. You know, you got the chicken in accounting, the stray dog, maybe there's a couple of stray cats lying around, right? So you as a lion are trying to get all these vast animals and all these people with different backgrounds, different interests, different education levels, divergent motivations and ambitions in their personal career, in their professional careers, and even in their personal lives, right? So you're trying to get broader organizations of various different people to move as an organization, as a single unit, into one direction to accomplish a mission, an end state, to meet corporate performance metrics, all sorts of other things. So why do I bring this up? Because what I have seen is there's a vast desire and need to hear from those amazing professionals in the special forces community to come and talk about organizational leadership, team leadership, organizational change and things like that. And that's not to say that they don't have any experience in the matter. What I'm saying is corporate America by and large, and the conventional force as well, is negating or ignoring the fact that there are currently, if you take the active duty and reserve components, 2.1 million people serving in the active duty army, or I'm sorry, the active duty military, right? So if the special forces community is a fraction of that population, right? Because I've looked and for obvious classified reasons, the actual number of special forces operators is classified. And so there's no access to that, thank God. But what about the other, 2 million people serving in the conventional force? Does that mean we're just running around leaderless? Does that mean that there's nobody out there that is able to provide purpose, direction, and motivation to the other 99.99% of people that go off and fight our nation's wars? No, of course not. There is a depth of leadership in the conventional force that I think is broadly ignored by corporate America, right? And I'll give you an example of that in my own personal life here recently. As everybody knows, I am transitioning out of military service, right? So now I have to go to all these programs that are provided by the Army and all these other things. And like, hey, this is how you write a resume and, things I already know, but it's good information to have. And they do their due diligence to ensure that soldiers that, are between the ages of 18 and 22 and never really maybe had a job are armed with the tools to go out and be successful in the private sector, right? So in one of these classes, they're like, hey, go to this website, type in your MOS. Let's take a look. You can even type in your education in there, and it's going to spit out some jobs that you're qualified for. Okay, great. This sounds like a really good tool. So I go and I input my MOS. I have a master's degree. I have an MBA, a bachelor's degree, obviously. And I type it in, and what's it spit out in the local area that I'm doing my job search, right? It shoots out assistant manager at CVS and security guard. Now, as a commander with 10 years of experience, I've managed people, organizations of 100 plus, had 7 direct reports, managed millions and millions of dollars of assets. I've coordinated with foreign nation government agencies, both U.S. and foreign, to execute operations while deployed in a hostile theater of Afghanistan. And none of that is coming into play. Now, I was curious, so I went back and I typed in the MOS 18 Alpha. If you don't know what that means, that's you're essentially a Green Beret team leader, right? You're an officer serving in the Special Forces community. And man, what a difference a couple of numbers and a letter makes, right? Because we as a society, and it's not wrong, are predisposed to really look to those guys that are at the tip of the spear, right? Those guys that are where the rubber meets the road in terms of, especially now in the last 17 years, when you look at the fight in foreign countries against insurgency, we're really predisposed to look at special forces operators for leadership, right? And everywhere you look at TED Talks There's this Navy SEALs talking about this topic. This Green Berets talking about this topic. This Army Rangers talking about this topic. When you look at books being published, you see that the preponderance of books being published out of the military are by special forces operators. And obviously these guys have something to say and they completely bring something to the table, but so do your conventional force people. And that's something that we forget. And that's actually reflected in how companies employ veterans, going back to my own personal example, right? If I were an 18 Alpha, I would be able to, you know, go assume middle management positions in wealth management, according to the site. Never mind that I didn't type in any education background or anything else like that, and I have an MBA. So I think we're really doing a disservice to those veterans who are coming out of the conventional side of the house, because these guys, right, are where the rubber meets the road. They have experience, and everybody wants to tell me like, oh, well, you know, it's soft experience. We're talking about leadership. We're talking about commitment. We're talking about perseverance, right? And we're going to talk about a lot of these things here in the next few minutes, to include adaptation and discipline. They bring all of those things to the table. And it was pretty funny, because when I told, and I'm not gonna drop any names on this podcast, but when I told the CEO, and I'm going to talk about him a little bit more later, he owns approximately 20 companies, all valued like upwards of $100 million. And this guy started out, and he himself is a veteran, right? He's not a special forces guy. He himself is a veteran. And when I told him, I looked him in the eye, I asked him, hey, what are some of your problems with middle management? He spat back at me like, you know, sometimes they just don't get it. There's a lack of drive there on occasion. They don't feel comfortable being team leaders and taking on responsibility. And then he went on to say something really interesting to me. He's like, in my world, in the private sector, and he's an entrepreneur who owns, again, like 20 companies all valued at about $100 million. What he has run into is that our civilian counterparts, those people that have never served in the military, don't want to take responsibility for teams. They don't want, by and large, obviously you can't talk in absolutes, but the vast majority of them don't want to be responsible for other people. Because why? And it's just like I talked about on previous podcasts, like, why are we afraid to empower junior leaders? If you haven't listened to it, I encourage you to do so. Because nobody wants to be responsible for the inaction of subordinates in the private sector, right? So there's a problem with people wanting to take on the responsibility of people. Right now, they're not afraid to take on more job responsibility, because job responsibility equals pay, right? You take on more responsibility, you expect to be compensated. But people are afraid in the private sector to take on responsibility for people. So I looked at him, I was like, okay, well tell me this, right? Like, what if I could give you a guy that was 25 years old, had at minimum a high school diploma and likely some college, who has evaluations in the form of superior officers who have rated him, who has at least 4 years experience providing purpose, direction, and motivation in an ambiguous environment to a team of anywhere between 10, 12 people, and has been highly successful at that, and is good in working with people of divergent interests, backgrounds, and ambitions. But he doesn't have the technical skills that you're looking for in one of your firms. What would you say? And he looked at me and he says, I would absolutely hire that guy. I can teach him technical stuff, but I can't teach him the leadership aspect. And pretty much I looked at him, I was like, what I have just explained to you is an E6 in the Army, you know, a section sergeant or a squad leader. And he was in the military. He knows this. So like, I think sometimes we as veterans forget that just how rich we are with attributes and abilities. And as the conversation pursued, and he's not the only conversation I've had in the last couple of weeks, he said something really poignant to me. And I really enjoyed his candor, because he's like, look, man, at the end of the day, companies, and this is true, and this is also going to hurt some feelings, don't give a shit that you're a veteran. He's like, we'll never admit it. Companies will never admit it. They'll never look you in the eye and say, look, man, I don't really care that you're a veteran. I really care about what you can do for my bottom line and what you bring to the table. But I appreciate his candor, but he's not wrong, right? Companies are quick to thank us for our service, but when it comes time to actually provide you a job offer, it really boils down to what you bring to the table and how you're going to improve their bottom line, right? And we as veterans have to understand that and expect that. Like, corporate America doesn't owe us anything. The civilian population really doesn't owe us anything, right? They owe us a thank you for service. We get a Veterans Day and whatever benefits we have earned, I hate the word entitlement, whatever benefits we have earned post-service, right? Nobody owes us a job. But they do a poor job of realizing that the traits that we bring to the table can, in fact, impact their bottom line, which is why a lot of veterans are underemployed. So going back to the initial conversation of why of Special Forces Operation does not have a monopoly on leadership, most corporations, you guys can't find enough Special Forces operators to fill your positions. And obviously those Special Forces operators that have entered the private sector have been extremely successful because, you know, they've earned a certain amount of respect. And with them comes an idea of what they bring to the table in terms of discipline and commitment and the ability to push through and persevere. But my argument is the vast majority of veterans provide the same discipline, initiative, ambition, intelligence, and bring that to the corporate table, right? Special Forces operations and Special Forces operators do not have a monopoly on leadership. The rest of the Army, the rest of the military does not run around like a chicken with its head cut off because we are not being led by a Special Forces operator, right? Or whomever is at the top of the food chain. Obviously, these guys are at the tip of the spear. Again, they're professionals. I'm not taking anything away from them. They bring a lot to the table. They clearly have a seat at the table of leadership and management and discipline, right? My argument here is that so does the rest of the conventional force. So do those commanders, right, in the infantry battalions and the armor battalions, the field artillery battalions, and your BSBs and everything else, everybody, right? Those commanders, those first sergeants, those squad leaders, those team leaders, all the way through the echelons of command, they all bring something to the table that can have a positive impact on your bottom line if you employ them properly, right? Like, and it's gotten a little bit ridiculous. I read a lot, and so I'm always on the search for new books. I read recently that, and I'm not going to name names or whatever, but, you know, Special Forces operator came out with a book of how to raise your kids by a blah 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 Special Forces operator. Like, me and my friends kind of joked around about, like, man, what does that mean? Like, you weren't. I'm supposed to, like, leave for 9 months at a time, come back, be home for 6 months, and leave 9 months at a time? Because, like, let's be real, these guys are always deployed. So I find it ironic that we can slap Special Forces on anything and call it good in terms of leadership or valid advice without really digging into the content of it, right? So I know some brigade commanders and some battalion commanders. I know company commanders, right? I have a really good friend of mine by the name of Ryan Orsini who just published a white paper on leadership, right? He's an infantry officer now doing a fellowship somewhere in Georgetown, right? And if he's listening to this podcast, Ryan, congratulations on all your success. But the rest of us are out there, right? Leadership is out there in the conventional force, right? So why is it? And so people ask me, like, well, Mike, what does that mean? Like, what does that mean? What do veterans actually bring to the table? Why are they any better than their civilian counterparts if, you know, they didn't go through the pipeline of Special Forces operations, right? They're not appearing on TED Talks or writing books. And my argument to that is absolutely. So everybody likes to talk about veteran unemployment, right? So for instance, and this is a report from the National Center for Veterans Analysis and Statistics. This report is dated December 2014. So between 2000 and 2013, right, veterans by and large had a lower unemployment rate than their civilian counterparts, right? Between 2000 and in the year 2000, veterans had a 3% unemployment rate versus 3.5%. In 2019, in 2008, 8% versus 9.25%, obviously because 2008 we saw the crash. And this year, 3.2%, which is an all-time low for veteran unemployment versus a 3.6% in our counterparts in the private sector. Why is that? Or for those people that are non-veterans, why is that? Well, it's because employers typically recognize the value that comes with hiring a veteran. 100%. They know what they're getting, but they continually underemploy us, right? So it's interesting when you consider that there's 20.8 million veterans in the United States. 20.8. Now, obviously, we're talking about guys that served in World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and all that. But when you look at the statistics, right, ages 18 to 44, right, which makes the bulk of those people that are currently working, the bulk of the veteran workforce, right, you're talking a grand total of 3,926,274 people. Now, of that 3,926,274 people, 60% believe that they're unemployed. Or correction, that they are underemployed, right? So 60% of 3,926,274 veterans believe that they are underemployed. Now, when you talk about all the skills that I just discussed, right, the things that your leaders in the conventional side of the house and your leaders on the special forces side of the house have in common, why do we continue to underemploy veterans? Why do companies think that we don't bring as much to the table? And it's interesting because I've been doing a lot of phone interviews for employment purposes recently, just so I can kind of gauge on this topic what it's like for a veteran trying to reemerge in the workforce. And so I got a phone call from a company, and I won't name them, right? They're a health company that does medical placement for doctors. And they initially called me, mind you, you know, I'm nearly done with my MBA and I have 7 years professional experience on top of more than 10 years military experience. And they called me about a sales job. Like, okay, well, I'll entertain. Pretty much I'll talk to anybody that's willing to have a conversation with me. That's always been my MO. And we got through the conversation and they actually offered me the job. I'm like, hey, you know, it pays $45,000 and you're expected to make 100 calls a day and this, that, and the other. And, you know, they always quote unquote untapped earning potential. Cause that's how they sink you or hook you. And I spoke to this woman. She was very polite. She was very nice. And I was like, you know, I have 17 years ish total experience. 10 years in the military. I'm almost done with my MBA. I have a bachelor's degree. I'm very business oriented, blah, blah, blah. I start rattling off all these things. And I'm like, do you really think that the position you're offering me is a good fit for me? Don't you feel like you're leaving a lot of my strengths on the table? She said, yes. Yes. Honestly, I think we are. I don't think you're a very good fit for this position. You're overqualified. And so when I reached out to some of my enlisted counterparts or my enlisted friends, they've run into several, all of them have run into similar situations. Or like you realize that I have the experience of leading a team of 12 in combat. I have the experience of maintaining equipment worth millions of dollars, answering, you know, providing reports and planning operations, strategic planning, project management, and all these other things. Like, whoa, we really didn't realize that you as a veteran had that kind of background. Well, yes, of course we do. Like most of us do, right? And I don't like to lump all veterans in the same category because we are a microcosm of the population. So you have to remember that not all veterans are considered or are created equal, right? And that's another topic for another day, but it's also another hard truth, right? So we continue to align military leadership skills, the ability to work in an ambiguous environment with special forces operations, right? And that's true. These guys are, again, they're good at what they do. But the people on the conventional side of the house, those officers, those enlisted personnel, are equally capable. And I would argue in some situations, more capable than special forces operators or your special forces community guys to manage cultural change or organizational change in a leadership in an organization. Mike, that's heresy. You can't say that. Well, yes I can, and I just did. And here's the reason why, because it goes back to my original analogy of the lion, right? Us on the conventional side of the house, again, are used to providing purpose, direction, and motivation to vast groups. We're talking groups of, in my situation, 100 in a battalion commander's viewpoint, you know, a few hundred at the E6, E7 level. You're talking about 10, 24, 50 people, depending on like what their MOS is. All people of different interests, different educational levels, different ambitions. Some people want to make the Army an entire career. They want to make Sergeant Major. Got other guys are like, look, man, I'm just trying to get out next week. Like if you give me my pink slip, I'll be home in 2 days. You know, so how do you take all those people, right, and get them to work together, get them trained up to a similar level, right? Because that's another thing on the conventional side of the house. We don't have the benefit of the elongated timeline to train and ensure that everybody is on the same level as far as skill set. We don't. We get privates that are now intermixed with E4s, E5s, your specialists, your sergeants, and there's the E6, the staff sergeant there, that's there to train those guys up and make sure that they're on par with everybody else so they can go out and execute. That E7 that oversees the entire platoon, that first sergeant that oversees an entire company, and it's his job to make sure that these dudes are trained. These dudes and dudettes are trained to a certain standard. We're doing that at the tactical level, right? Our privates just don't show up able to execute at a level of a sergeant or an E6. We have to build them up. We have to get them there. That's why obviously there's promotion. But we have that background. We have the organizational leadership background to affect change in your organizations if you give us the opportunity. So some other interesting facts, right? According to an SBA report, veteran-owned businesses equate to 2.5 million businesses in the United States. Veteran-owned businesses employ 5.9 million people and represent 9.1% of overall businesses in the United States. Right? So that's a report by the SBA. And the reason why veteran entrepreneurship is so high when compared to, you know, your non-vets is in a report listed by the NewYorkFed.org dated November 2018, military service is highly correlated with self-employment. There is a 45% probability that a veteran will become an entrepreneur versus those that are non-vets. And the reason for this is 60% of veterans who are interviewed say that the reason they decided to start their own business was because everywhere they looked, they were dissatisfied with the civilian workforce because it was disorganized and every job they had underemployed them. So the bulk of veterans that started their own business actually held a conventional job for two or three in some instances, but they eventually got fed up due to the civilian disorganization and the fact that they were constantly underemployed. They weren't able to leverage their skills, their leadership. They weren't able to show off they weren't given the opportunity to show what they were capable of, and they were typically underemployed. So they said, hey, I'm just going to go start my own business because I'm a veteran. I have the skills that these companies think I don't have. So why am I just going to sit here and continue to be underemployed, not make enough money, when I'm brave enough to go out and do it on my own? You know what I mean? So you have to also look at the fact that 36% of veterans coming out of the military had no interest. 36% of these entrepreneurs that were interviewed, these veteran entrepreneurs, when they first left the military, had zero interest in starting their own business. But they just became fed up. They just became fed up, right? So what does that mean for corporations and businesses? Look, that's great for veterans. Like, that's great for veterans, right? And also plays to the fact that veterans, because we're responsible, because we've learned these skills in the military, and companies are leaving our strengths on the table. 100%, right? Again, unless you're, if you were to look at social media and you were to look at all the books coming out and all the interviews and the movies being done and everything else, you would think that veterans just come out of the military and we don't know anything. So this is especially true on the civilian or on the enlisted side of the house, right? But what companies fail to realize is that 8 out of 10 military officers, 8 out of 10 DOD officers have a bachelor's degree. 42% of those hold an advanced degree. That's four times as likely to earn a postgraduate degree than our civilian counterparts ages 18 to 44. Now, that's obvious, right? Like, everybody expects that, you know, military officers are going to be a little bit more educated. Like, there's a lot of educational requirements that come into that position that allow you to lead, right? Well, Mike, what about the enlisted guys? Well, guess what? Unsurprisingly, the enlisted personnel on the conventional side of the house in the military also outperform their civilian counterparts. 92% have completed high school or some college versus 60% of the average adult. in the rest of the U.S. population, right? So not only do they have the skills, not only do they have the direct team leadership, not only do they have the experience, a lot of times they have the education. But civilian corporations don't look at a lot of those things as, you know, education. If an E6 walks into a meeting and says, I graduated from, you know, WLC, well, I don't know what that is. And then a lot of times the staff sergeants, it's hard to put that into words, right? Because veterans, we do a poor job of translating our military service into civilian speak, which is something that we need to own and take responsibility for. They don't know what that means, but that's a really good program. It's educational. It's leadership based, right? Shows you how to be a leader. How many E5s, E6s, sergeants, staff sergeants do I know that have Ranger tabs that get out of the Army? You know, and the Ranger School is the premier Army leadership school. How many of those guys have Ranger tabs? When they get out of the Army, they have problems finding work because nobody wants to give them a leadership position. Like, and obviously, all of us have to realize as a veteran community that we need to sometimes start at the bottom, right? But what happens is corporations have a tendency to start us off at the bottom and leave us there. You don't have the education. You don't have the skills. You don't have the technical skills, right? Listen, it's just like I told another chief operating officer of a logistics company. You know, I can plug a staff sergeant into almost any of your lower leadership positions, and he'll be successful. Even if he doesn't have the technical skills, he can learn them. You can teach him, right? Now, while the kid that's coming out of college, who's only gone to school his entire life, maybe he got his bachelor's, did a year of work, then went off and get his master's, right? He has the technical skills, great. But when it's 9:30 in the morning and he's still getting his soy latte, his skinny soy latte over at Starbucks, and you're wondering where he is, your veteran community, I would argue about 80% of the time, has already been at work for at least an hour and is pushing to meet your organizational end states. You cannot teach type of commitment, dedication, perseverance, adaptability that all veterans bring to the table, not just the special forces community, right? And we're living right now, and what's funny is everybody, and what's popular is there's a big push for diversity. We see diversity everywhere, you know, and it's great. It's great. Women are increasing their numbers in the workforce at C-suite level, and that's true in the military too, right? When you want to talk about diversification, you want to talk about change in diversity, the military is always the first place you should look because we lead from the front in those areas, right? So since 1999, female population of military personnel has increased from 9% to 17%. Right? When you talk about the diversification of the United States, you have to remember that as the United States becomes more diverse, so does the United States military, right? So currently ethnic groups make up 40% of the active duty and reserve components. That's up from 25% in 1990, right? Because again, it goes back to people in the conventional side of the house and people in special forces community, I would imagine, are we grow up professionally in a world of diverse people, different religions, backgrounds, socioeconomic backgrounds, educational levels, family dynamics, like you name it, it's there. And now we have to work as a team. The military is probably the most diverse organization in the United States, I would argue. So we're used to that. We're used to leading people that have those various backgrounds. We welcome a culture of inclusion. We welcome a culture of diversity because that's what we're used to because everybody brings so much to the table when they have divergent backgrounds, right? And that's what makes this conventional force so unique when you compare it to the special operations force, right? So again, that's not to say that these guys don't have a seat at the table. They clearly and obviously do. Right? Like they are the tip of the spear and I'm not taking anything away from them. But what we as a country and what we as in the private sector need to understand is that there is so much being left on the table when it comes to the strengths of the veterans that are currently exiting military service, right? If I am a squad leader that's been to three or four different professional military educational programs and I have an associate's degree, right? You should probably pick me up, right? If you've done your due diligence, and a lot of corporations don't do their due diligence, they assume that all veterans are created equal, and they don't do their due diligence in looking at CD-214s and evaluations and things like that. They kind of just like roll the dice, right? But if they do their due diligence, they'll find that that staff sergeant, that or that sergeant, will pay huge dividends. And now when it comes to like your real rock stars, like I have seen staff sergeants that could walk into company command billets. I've met command sergeant majors and first sergeants that could walk into a brigade command billet and not skip a beat, right? For those rock stars, right? If you have them in your office and you're a hiring manager, if you don't scoop him up, you're going to regret it. You might not even know that you're going to regret it. You're going to regret it, right? Because you would probably have to hire two people to make up for the production and performance of that one guy. Be like, oh, Mike, come on, dude. They're not all rock stars. No, you're right. They're not all rock stars, right? Like I said before, it's a microcosm of the rest of the country. Like, we have our own problems. Not all veterans are created equal. I've said that. And to that point, not all special forces operators have a monopoly on leadership, right? They play a role. We play a role. We're good at what we do. They're good at what they do. We're exceptional at creating organizational change within large organizations. They're phenomenal at team leadership. You give these guys an organization, a team of highly educated, professional, dedicated people, and I promise you, they will crush it, right? If you give me or somebody like me coming out of the conventional force an organization of 50 plus of divergent interests, ambitions, educational levels, training levels, I will turn that organization around and we will move in a direction that benefits the organization. We will exceed performance metrics, right? And that is vastly true across the board, right? Now, obviously, you're not going to throw, like, there are certain levels of common sense that you have to apply. The point being that there is a tremendous amount of talent, potential, intelligence, leadership capability, perseverance, adaptation in the veteran community that is being left on the table. And now for those veterans that are tired of the bullshit and they're going off and starting their own successful businesses, good for you. Good for you. I'm proud of you. And the rest of the veteran community should be proud of you, right? What does that mean to companies? That means a lot of that talent that you need, those people that you've been seeking that have been right in front of you this entire time, are going to go out and they're going to start their own businesses, and now they're going to become your competition, right? So when you look at the entrepreneurial statistics for veterans, it's really interesting. So veterans that have owned businesses of five or more people are 45% more likely to be more successful than their non-veteran counterparts, because they're used to that organizational, they're used to that leadership role. They're used to that project management. The more people you give them, their growth will be exponential. Where we see trouble on the entrepreneurial side of the house when it comes to veterans is actually companies that have less than five employees. Because veterans, we're used to leading teams, right? If you're a corporate manager, you're a hiring manager, you're a company, and you can't find people that are chomping at the bit to lead a team on a project, I would look in your ranks and see if you can find a veteran. Put him in charge of that project, give him some team members, and then come back and tell me if he didn't absolutely crush it. Well, that's all the time that we have for today's podcast. Thank you for tuning in. I hope you guys tune in next week when we do our first War Room podcast interviews with Sergeant First Class retired Rob Carpenter. Rob's going to be talking about his transition from military service to entrepreneurship while combating PTSD. We're also going to have Dr. Nathaniel Chapman, a clinical psychologist and veteran himself, helping us shed some light on why it's so difficult after veterans transition from the military to battle a lot of the demons that prevent us from being successful and some of the tools that we can use to combat those demons and ultimately be as successful as Sergeant First Class Rob Carpenter in all of his entrepreneurial ventures. All right, so I hope you guys tune in next week. That's going to be a flagship episode. It's going to be really awesome. Make sure you subscribe to the War Room podcast on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Anchor, or your favorite podcast platform.
You've just been debriefed in the War Room with Michael Blanco. If you've enjoyed this week's meeting, make sure you subscribe to us on your favorite podcasting platform. As always, remember, don't be so afraid to lose that you forget how to win.